It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Sports Legends of the Carolinas. I'm your host, Scott Fowler, sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer, where I've worked since 1994. And as always in this podcast, I'm traveling across the Carolinas, seeking out some of my favorite sports legends and asking them to tell me some of the stories behind their rise to iconic status. Now, for this episode, we're delighted to be in Denver, North Carolina, inside the Lincoln Charter High School basketball gym. We've met up here with former NC State basketball player Tommy Burleson, who was kind enough to make the drive from Western North Carolina to the gym at my local high school. Burleson won a national championship in 1974 with a Wolfpack team that also included David Thompson and Monty Tau. At more than 7 feet tall, Burleson was a mountain of a man who grew up in the mountains of North Carolina. The College All-American also played for the U.S. Olympic team in 1972 and was named the two-time MVP of the ACC tournament. After a seven-year NBA career that ended in 1981, Burleson returned to his home state and he's been a larger-than-life presence in North Carolina ever since. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. My privilege to be here.
Let's start with your height, since that's the first thing people have probably noticed about you for most of your life. What was the height you were listed at NC State, and what was your true height?
Well, coming out of high school, I was 7'1", and, of course, my idol was a Lou Alcindor. And then, of course, Artis Gilmore, he's about 7'1", but he listed 7'2" also. So I was anxious for the day for when I would be listed at 7'2". And Frank treated me like a circus act, and he listed me at 7'4". When I was measured in the Olympics, I was 7'2½". When I was measured in the NBA combine, I was like 7'2¼". The first time I ever played against Lou Alcindor as a buck, you know, we were like boxers. We walk up to each other and we measure each other up to see who's bigger. And the first words Lou Alcindor ever said to me was, "You're not 7'4". I says, "I know, I'm 7'2". And then, you know, Walton's real ballistic about it also. I mean, he's 6'11". He don't want to be over that 7 foot mark. But, you know, physically, the tallest I've ever been measured is 7'2½", and I was in the Olympics. And I just wanted to be there with my icons of Artis and Kareem and stuff. And, of course, Frank and I did not agree on that at all.
Frank
Wheaton, sports information director. He treated us like a circus act. He had Monty, and he had David the high wire act, and then he had me as a giant. And I wanted to be known for my ability. I had a 29-inch vertical. I'm still like the third leading shooting percentage at NC State at 56.4. David's 56.6. I led my high school in free throw shooting at 87%. I was the first North Carolina player ever playing the National All-Star Game. Back then, you only was allowed one postseason All-Star Game, so they banned me from the North Carolina All-Star Game because I played in the Dapper Dan and the National All-Star Game. But I'm 7'2". Right now, I'm not even 7'2". I'm more like 7'1", barely over 7 feet. So that's it. It
7'4" was just to make you the tallest player in college basketball.
Yeah.
All the NC State media guides listed him at 7'4" tall, but he was actually 7'2" tall. Now, regardless, he became a giant figure to the success of NC State basketball. In 1974, he averaged 18 points, 12 rebounds a game. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Burleson.
I think I know the answer to this, but let me ask it. Were your parents particularly tall?
My father was right at, you know, he was a Green Beret. Well, I was in the 101st, of course, there in D-Day and didn't come out re-upped and became 82nd. But, yeah, he was right at 6'3", you know, a tall 6'3". My mother was right at 6 feet. And then my grandfather had one like 6'3", or 6'4", and another one was 6'6". So on three sides of my family, they were quite tall people. We've been in Avery County since 1725, or that part of the country. And since
your family has been? Right. Yeah. Well, tell us about growing up.
Well, growing up, we was in a very rural area. Of course, agriculture was the dominant portion of that. At 10 years old, I was working for 25 cents an hour in the cabbage fields. And then as I got bigger, you know, I went up to like 45 cents an hour. And then we get into the hay fields. And so I was really involved in 4-H and FFA. And that was where I, you know, fell in love with NC State when I was down there as a middle school student. I was doing row silage, a demonstration for 4-H. And then, of course, I was a part of the tool team my freshman year that there at Newland and stuff. So I was on the NC State's campus. I was able to see Glassy the Cow for the first time there in front of Reynolds. Of course, that was the corner where Coach Sloan's office was. And as a freshman, I was about 14 years old, and I was about 6'8". My uncle and I walked into Coach Sloan's office and introduced myself. I said, well, this is Tommy Burleson. I'm from West North Carolina. And Coach Bryant said, well, he's 6'8", Coach. And Coach says, well, we've got a ton of 6'8 guys. And he said, but he's only 14. So he came out and he greeted me, and it was really nice. And I just sort of fell in love with the school and just had that dream. I could see that position where I could, you know, sort of slide in there and play center.
And so explain exactly where that is you're talking about, because not everyone who listens to this will know North Carolina geography. Where is Avery County, or was it actually Newland? Where do you say
Newland's where I'm from. It's, you say Grandfather Mountain, a lot of people can yeah. identify with that. Banner Elk. We're just 22 miles south of Boone, which is Appalachian State, 55 miles north of Asheville. That western part of the state runs at a diagonal. And when you realize Tennessee's north, you drive north to Johnson City, you drive north to Bristol. You know, and we were like 45 minutes from, you know, Bristol Motor Speedway and stuff like that. I live like 4 miles off the Appalachian Trail.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful country up there.
So, I mean, we're the very edge of the Blue Ridge. And, of course, Mitchell County comes in there, and that's the Smoky Mountains. So you have Mount Mitchell, which is the tallest mountain in the Smokies. And, of course, Grandfather is the tallest mountain in the Blue Ridge.
They called you the Newland Needle, right?
Newland Needle, yeah.
Did you like that nickname?
That's fine. I mean, it was you know, Seattle, and was it 63 or something like that? They had the Space Needle. It was a big part of the World's Fair. And, of course, I was long and thin, and you know, and just and so depicted me as the Newland Needle, and that, you know, that sort of stuck.
In 1974, as a senior, you helped lead NC State to a national championship. So there were describe the four major personalities on that team to me a little bit. Yourself, but also Coach Norm Sloan, and then David Thompson and Monty Towle. How did they mesh personality-wise?
I guess perfect, because we won a national championship. Almost perfect. Well, that'll be a part of my book, too. I mean, we were 57-1 over 2 years, and that's the – you know, all undefeated in all ACC play, tournament and regular season. Those records will probably never be matched. So, Monty was Coach Sloan's coach on the court. Monty ran the offense.
Monty was an extension of the coach. You know, he's like the coach on the floor. The guys on the team always said that Coach Sloan was Monty's dad.
He was unbelievable on running the offense. Getting the ball in on a triangle, was isolating David on the left, on the right side a lot. Bill Walton, in the Skywalker documentary, he said David Thompson was the best player of our era. And David, I mean, he was recorded at like a 44-inch vertical. We just complimented each other. You know, when the double team would come to him, he'd throw the ball to me, and then when the ball would come into me, Coach Sloan wanted me not to be a black hole. Coach Sloan, he's in my sophomore year, I was like, second in the conference in scoring, and of course I led the conference in 2 years in rebounding at 14 and a half rebounds a game. But He said, when the ball comes in, he says, you need to keep it moving to make sure that defense works a lot and they can't, you don't take a bad shot. So I touched the ball two or three, four times during a series, and then it'd either get David open or somebody find open for an open shot. Phil Spence was a great player on my backside. Timmy Stoddard was a great player. Both power forwards. It boxed out really well. And when called upon to, make a crucial shot, they were there. They were there in the right place. What I call the passing seam, just a step in, and drop it in. Mo Rivers, he had led the junior college in scoring. And now he's coming in to a team that he's maybe going to get six or eight shots a game. So Mo was sacrificed a lot, played great defenses, really long arms, really quick. Monty ran the offense. I ran the defense.
And what was David's personality like and yours, and how did the two of you do?
We did well. I mean, we were big fans. Like I say, in high school, I mean, that's, and David mentions it in his book, and I'll mention it in my book. We played in the same high school conference, and we wanted to play together. We're very good friends. We're still great friends today. He's going to be doing my camp again this year. We've done it for 40 years. He gives a great witness, great testimony. He teaches, shooting so well. And he's very calm. David led by example.
David being able to do what he does, I always say, and everybody agrees, this is Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan was there. I guarantee you Michael Jordan got his inspiration from that man right there.
And Monty was that little military leader like Coach Sloan. Coach Sloan was military. He was what I needed. He was very strict on me, and then I'd been taught to train hard. He said I was the only 7-footer that would show up in the gym an hour 15 minutes before practice, start my miking drills, start my tipping drills, start my line drills, do my hand-eye coordination drills. And I was taught by Bruce Daniels in high school, and Roger Bank was the other coach. To walk straight to the foul line after practice and start shooting foul shots while you're still tired. There was no, dissension between the team. We loved each other. We still love each other. I do a little online, like a little sermon every weekend with the team members that are still living and stuff. And
really,
and that's, cool. It's all good. And like I said, but Coach Sloan was, he was adamant about his discipline and stuff.
I was speaking with some people out front, and they asked me about Norm Sloan. And what people they asked me if he lived up to the nickname of Storm and Norman. And I always felt like he did that to take some pressure off of us so that people would be on him instead of yelling at David or Tommy or me during the game. But he was a Sunday school teacher. He would take a prisoner out of the Raleigh prison, bring him around the team every weekend. There was a lot of things that Norm Sloan did that nobody ever knew about.
He called me in my junior year, and he says, this team can't lose. I said, really? He goes, yeah. He says, your offense is amazing. He says, we have just too many weapons. He says, I can call on anybody and we can score at any time. He looked at me and said, I'm going to focus on defense. And that's what he did. I mean, yeah, Dwight Johnson keeps saying, Burleson beats us on the suicides. He's 7 feet tall. 7 foot guys can't beat you on suicides. And I'd beat him by about 12 feet. And he's just like, God. So I ran one group and David ran the other group. And I was, that was my father, Green Beret. He would get me up at 9 years old and we'd run like anywhere from 2 to 3 miles in the morning, come back, do calisthenics. Then of course I'd feed the cattle, the milk cows. And then that afternoon we'd feed the 200 head of beef cattle. And of course, we only had 60 acres of cabbage, row crops, and stuff.
Maybe an athlete. Didn't have to be tall.
Yeah.
You mentioned off air, but tell us about your very favorite trophy that you own.
Well, my very favorite trophy is I competed in the Western North Carolina Livestock Show for many years, and in my senior year, I had a really good Angus beef. He weighed about 1,400 pounds, and I showed him, and I received the showmanship award. But he was the grand champion. And my mother still says that's my favorite trophy. And it probably is because back then you didn't get participant trophies. If you received a trophy, you received it for actually doing something. Yeah, for accomplishing that feat. And I was tickled to death with my grand champion beef that year.
We'll be back right after this. Welcome back.
Okay, Tommy, so to go back for a moment before we get deeper into your run in 1974, let's go to 1972, where you had some really remarkable experiences at the Olympics as a 20-year-old. And first of all, let's go with the most brutal and difficult thing that's probably ever happened in the Olympics. You happened upon a terrorist attack against the Israeli Olympians, if you'll tell us that story.
When German police close in, all the hostages and 8 terrorists die during an airport shootout.
Palestinian militant group Black September claimed responsibility for the attack, which shocked the world. Millions of viewers watched it unfold on live TV.
Well, the night it happened, that they, our barracks, or you know, those apartments have like a second life, and we're staying in like one of the apartment units, and we hear like, well, it's gunshots, and I think it's fireworks, and Kevin Joyce says, no, that's gunfire. And then all of a sudden we're all, you know, anxious about what's going on. And then of course, as we come down to breakfast, we realize it's under siege. And
in the Olympic Village?
In the Olympic Village, yeah. Our quarters, our well, I guess you call it barracks, but our quarters there in the Olympic Village looked right down on the Israeli building and where they were staying. And like I said, we heard the gunfire that night. And then we started looking at pictures, and I was saying, well, I had lunch with him and I had breakfast with him. And we ate at the same mess hall. And of course the Canadian guys, their room was right dead even with the Israelis in the second building. There's a building that was here, and I was here, the Israeli building here. So I said, you want to go back and see it? And I said, sure. I mean, I was that, you know, 20 curious. And so we went back, and then there was like cameramen all over the place in these rooms, in these athletes' rooms, because I mean it was had been no security at this time. And they were like, you know, taking pictures of there, and you could see the terrorists walking back and forth in the green leisure suit and stuff like that. I'm going like, you know, and you could see the Uzi in his hands. I'm going like, this is not a very safe place. So I left pretty immediately. But then again, of course, all that was cleared out as the German police and soldiers began taking over the Olympics village. First day, first 24 hours, we went to McGraw, shot, sat around. They brought us a box lunch. We went back to our dorm, our barracks, or you know, it was the apartment, Olympic Village unit. And like I said, we were on like the fifth or sixth floor, and we looked down on the but we were not allowed to go on the balcony this time now. So the next day, they said, you either have to stay in your room, not do anything, or you can go into Munich and see the town. Well, my girlfriend, Debbie Rice, she was there. And so I said, well, I'll go meet up with her. So I went to her apartment where her parents had got her a room to stay in, like a little hostel, something like that. And she and I got together, and we went back to the AT&T phone station. They had about 85, I think it was like 85 or 90 telephones, landlines. And so we called our parents. She called her parents. Then we went to the across town to a McDonald's, which was full of Americans. We was eating McDonald's. And then we came back through the Black Forest, and I bought a clock for my mother and that kind of stuff. And she bought some stuff for her parents. So I took her back to her room, her apartment, her hostel there. And I headed back to the Olympic Village. And so I was on the train back to the Olympic Village, and I was in the very last car. And the only way I can really explain that this happened was the Olympic station was so full. Now you needed, before you only needed one piece of ID, but now you needed all three pieces. You needed your armband, your tag, and your ID. And so it was a log jam there at the station, probably 200 or 300 people in there. So what happened is the train, the only way I can figure it out, is stopped short of its marks. And when the door opened, it was two Brazilian players, their center and their big forward, big guys. And we were in the last car by ourselves. And when our door opened, we walked out, and that there was the barricade with the German soldiers facing the crowd. Well, we were behind the crowd, and the double metal doors were right there, and you could see through the glass, and I could see through the parking lot that nobody was really there, and the garage door entrance to our building was just right there. That's the way we'd been going in and out the whole time. And I said, "So you want to cut across the parking lot?" And they went, "Sure, lead the way," and went across the parking lot, and the German soldiers are coming up to us, and they're speaking in German, and I don't speak the Deutsch, and so as we're entering the garage, a German soldier comes up to me, and he says, "Young man, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time." I said, "What?" He said, "We're bringing out the hostages right now." So I looked to my left, and then the two Brazil players were laying down, face down in the parking lot, and they had soldiers with guns in their back. He says, "You face that wall," which is the wall of the garage, where the cars come in, the driveway where the cars come in and out. So I'm facing the wall, and then all of a sudden we start hearing motion behind us. When I start hearing motion, I look, and there's the Israeli terrorist. He steps out from behind the wall, one of the corners, and I look at him, and he looks at me, and it's probably, 30, 35 feet or something like that. And the German soldier takes the gun out of my back, and he sticks it in the back of my head, and he says, "Face the wall." Now I have a pretty good eidetic memory, and I can close my eyes, and I can see those blemishes in that concrete right now. And then as they start walking behind me, I can hear the young men, a couple of them are crying. And so they're leaving the security of the hostages are leaving the security of the Olympic Village. So you can sort of tell they have their fate sealed. So as that small bus is behind us and they're loading them in, I can hear the Arabics snapping commands, and I can hear the feet shuffling, and I can just hear all that motion behind me. But really, I wake up at night sometimes just in fright and terror, dreaming about those young men, and because within 45 minutes they're all going to be dead. They're going to be blown up in those helicopters.
In the end, 11 members of the Israeli team were killed, along with one German police officer and five of the Palestinian gunmen. German and Olympic authorities faced bitter criticism for their response to the attack.
And I can just hear their emotion as I can just address right now. It just tears me apart as I hear their emotion. And I think about their families and they're just walking into their death. And so once
a botched rescue operation is what happened, for those who don't know. Right. They went to these helicopters and ended up a hand grenade was tossed in there.
There is a documentary out there, and it's sort of hard to find. But yeah, the Germans wanted to do it themselves. They didn't. The Americans and the Russians had sharpshooters, and they tried to sharpshoot once, and they told him if he tried it again, they'd blow him up. And then what they did is they had these Adidas bags. Back then it looked like a square Adidas bag. It was full of hand grenades, and they pulled a pin on one and just threw that whole bag of grenades in there. So when you see the documentary, it's the helicopters is ground zero. They ran out. Now two of them were killed at the site, and then six were then, of course, a part of the hostage release in 1977, when it took the Israeli airplane, their commercial airplane. They took them hostage, and had like 200 and some Israelis, and they had 160 some political prisoners released. It was a big hostage exchange, and they were part of that.
The German soldier that had his gun pressed into the back of your neck was actually doing that for your own good?
Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, he was saying, because I had a USA coat on, and today, I mean, that's the first time Black September ever showed its ugly face. So, and today it could have been very, I mean, if they saw that USA, they could have said, "We want him too," and put him on the bus with them. I mean,
absolutely.
It could have been catastrophic for me, but God was protecting me, and God had his angels there.
The Olympics continued, which I wonder if they would today in the same situation, but they did after a pause. And not long after that came the gold medal, controversial gold medal title game, which you did not play in. And describe why.
Describe why? Because I think I asked, told you, my girlfriend had came into Olympic Village with me. We'd had supper, and I'd taken her up to the our apartment, and we were on the balcony overlooking Olympic Village, and Coach Bach come out and says, what are you doing here with a female? I said, well, she's my girlfriend. I said, everybody else has had their girlfriends and their mothers and their sisters and everybody up here. I said, we're just out here standing on the balcony. And he said, well, you're not supposed to do that. And I said, all right. He said, I'm not going to tell Coach Iba, and I'm not going to tell Coach Bach. I said, well, that's fine. I appreciate that. But he did. He ended up telling him. And so I was, they told me that I was lucky. I guess Coach Iba, he would send you home. I mean, he'd throw you off the team, kick you off the team for a heartbeat. But the coaches had like 4 days to think their game plan over. We'd been playing American ball, transition, fast break, blowing everybody out of the water. For some reason, Iba and went back to his old 1950s basketball, and we went to a slow down, very methodical, running plays. And we were down 8 points with about 5 minutes to go, 4 minutes to go. Of course, you have a 30-second shot clock. And Kevin Joyce called the time. There was a timeout call, and Kevin Joyce looked at Coach Ivan. He says, Coach, we have to start pressing, and we have to start pushing the ball. We have to start, running some fast breaks, really, stepping the tempo up. And Coach Ivan says, what? He says, we've got our plan. We're going to stick with you. And Kevin's going, he's like, Coach, we're going to run out of time. Tom Anderson chimed in right with Kevin. He says, Coach, we've got to start pressing, putting pressure on the ball and creating turnovers, or we're not going to, the game's going to be over. And then Iba looked at his number one man, Doug Collins. He looked at Doug, and he said, Doug, do you agree with Kevin and Tom? And he said, yeah, Coach, we need to, step it up and start, putting pressure on the ball and try to get some easy baskets. And then Iba, of course, he was old, and I loved him to death, but he just blew up. You boys don't know what you're doing. You want to play the game? You want to coach the game? Go out there and you do whatever the heck you want. I'll be sitting over here and you just let me know how it turns out. And I'm going like, ooh, okay. So they went out there, Doug and Tom and Kevin set up the defense. And we created the turnovers, and they brought the team back. And, of course, Dwight Jones had been thrown out for fighting. Jim Brewer had a concussion. I was basically your only center left on the team.
But I don't know if the listeners know, but so I think you described it. But you were – they had said you can't play because you had brought your girlfriend up on the balcony.
Right.
Is that – they told you that beforehand.
Yeah. They told me that when I went to ask to play.
Okay.
Because I said, Coach, are you going to put me in the game? He said, no, you had an unauthorized person in your room. And I went, really? And then of course, the next year in 73, when we beat the Russians with David Thompson, Quinn Buckner, Maurice Lucas, and all those guys, the coach from Russia asked me, he said, why didn't you play? I said, well, I was being punished because I had an unauthorized person in the room. And he went, he said, you might have run 500 suicides. He said, but I would not have. He said, that was a big mistake not playing you. And I said, well, that was my opinion too.
I would agree. Well, and so to move on, but they, at the end, America's up by one, Russia's got the ball. You could have been in there helping right. out to guard the big guy.
Right.
And instead, what happened?
Okay, we came back, of course. And so when Doug shoots his second shot, the buzzer goes off. Well, the coach was trying to wait to the last second, and he didn't realize that you had that human time lapse between that and the timeout. So once the ball goes through the hoop or is in play in Doug's hand, only a player can call timeout. That's the rules, international rules. A coach can't call a timeout, only a player, active player on the court. Well, they grab the ball, take it out, throw it in, game's over. President of FIBA, Federal International Basketball Association, he comes out of the stands. He says, no, put the time back on the clock. So I say, okay. So they're putting the time back on the clock. And I'm looking at Ivan. I said, we need to set up our defense. He's going, we're putting this game into protest. Don't leave me alone. Talk to Haskins. I look at Haskins. I said, we need to set up our defense in the front court. I said, we have a one-point lead. We don't need to steal the ball. We have to just, when they make that one pass, that person's got to shoot. With 3 seconds, they don't have time to make a second pass. I said, we have to cheat to the ball wherever they throw the ball and have two people standing in front of them and make them make a horrendous shot in order to beat us. Don't you worry, we're handling the game. Go talk to Bach. And I went to John. And I said, John, I said, are we going to set up a defense in the front court? And he goes, don't you worry about anything. You're not playing. You know you're not playing. I said, you've got me and Bobby Jones sitting here on the court. I said, you've got two of the biggest people on your team.
Was Bobby in the game at that time?
No, Bobby no. wasn't. They didn't put Bobby in the game. That, and Bobby, you know, he's really a poor defensive player because, you know, he's only first team all NBA 11 years in a row. I mean, right. I'm being very sarcastic here. Bobby,
right, right, Bobby right. Jones. That's why he made the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Right? Bobby, defensive I mean, wizard.
Yeah. He was key in Philadelphia's championship. I mean, Bobby's an excellent person and a great friend. And he and I, as a teammate, it was just awesome. But I was there campaigning for both of us to get into the game. We set the defense up. And we had four guys in the backcourt. Poor little Jimmy Forbes, who had came in for John Brown, 160 pounds soaking wet. And Jimmy is back there on Bailoff. I mean, he's probably got 23-inch biceps, and, you know, a 54, 56-inch chest. I mean, just a monster. And he just armbars Jimmy, catches the ball, lays it in as his brother throws him the ball.
Now, before the game, we told you the story through Marv Albert's reporting of the U.S. disappointment in 1988 when they settled for bronze. But really, when you look back over the Olympic history of U.S. basketball, the biggest disappointment came in 1972. The greatest controversy, perhaps, in the history of all organized basketball. Never been a more controversial game than the gold medal contest in Munich in 1972. There, the Soviets dealt the Americans their first ever Olympic loss.
And then the second time, we had went into the dressing room, and they come in and told us, says, well, you will forfeit the game if you don't come back out and play it again. So we had to go back out on the court and play again. It was all kind of chaos.
Double mulligan. Oh, my goodness. It's still hard to believe. And so the postscript to that is you didn't take the silver medals right. And didn't go to the medal ceremony either.
Right. Everybody but myself, we were told to just go out and scatter out and don't be near the Olympic arena stadium. And we did. And, of course, the big thing shows our medals laying there on the stand. And they call it the worst sportsmanship in history.
Would you take that silver medal today?
No, because the teammates, we voted to it is either all for one and one for all. So three guys have it in their wills that they're not to accept it. So I really don't want it. You know, Tom McMillan's tried to do different things with it. He wants it returned to the Naismith Hall of Fame and put in their archives, you know, stored away instead of having it in Geneva. There's only seven left right now. Five of them are missing. Who knows where they are? Probably some private collection somewhere. I don't know. But
that's interesting.
But I really don't want it. I mean, there's not one for everybody.
We'll be back right after this. Welcome back.
The 1974 ACC championship game is commonly regarded as the best game ever played in the conference. And it was, I think, in March, but I was there at this extraordinary reunion where you spoke, six players spoke overall, three from NC State, three from Maryland. And we'll listen to what you said there for a moment.
It was more than a dogfight. We went out at each other knowing that, you know, we're on national TV. And people, that's what, you think we have egos? you think we may be alpha males? I mean, we're out here playing a game with our full hearts and our passion, and we're in front of a national televised audience. So every game was intense, every game was just unbelievable, and it was always one thing that stood out in my mind. We had it.
So what made that 1974 ACC championship game so special in your estimation? All these years later, people still remember it.
There was a whole lot going on there. I mean, we were put on probation my junior year, David's sophomore year, 27-0. We went undefeated in the conference and won the ACC tournament. Then, of course, in 73-74 season, we go undefeated in the conference, and then we go and we win the tournament. So that gives us a berth in the NCAA. At that time, there was only 25 berths in the NCAA. That game is what prompted the NCAA to go to a bigger field. At that time, the ACC is the only one that had a conference tournament that would determine the NCAA representative. So they went from 25 to 32, and they said, wow, what a cash cow. And then they went from 32 to 42, 42, 48, 48 to 64. Now it's 68 because of television rights and everything. So that was the game that planted the seed in the mind of NCAA that they needed to expand the field. So that was the big part of it. And then again, Maryland was just trying to beat us. I mean, we're that team. We're the only team in ACC history to go undefeated in conference and tournament play two years in a row. Sorry about that, Dukies, but you don't have that one. You got most of them, but you don't have that one. And I don't think you're going to get it. I don't think you're going
to
get it again.
That's pretty hard to do. Yeah. Yes. And the score was 103 to 100. Without a shot clock, without a three-point shot, how did that happen?
Well, the transition. Maryland had a lot of great athletes, and they liked to score. And we had a lot of great athletes, and we liked to score. So it was a lot of transition up and down, and the game was really at a fever pitch, I guess, is a good way to put it. And, of course, we went into overtime. And during the overtime, I'm looking down at the Maryland bench, and I'm seeing Lynn Elmore pop the ammonia. And Tom McMillan's got his hands on his knees, and he's bent over at the waist. So, I mean, he's showing that he's tired, and I'm looking at Coach Sloan going like, yep, the coach is going there. He says, we got to pull this out. I said, don't worry, Coach, we've got this. I said, we got it. Really, I'd get into a situation where the game would almost go into slow motion. I mean, if you'll watch that game, I'm at every play. I was anticipating everything. Everybody said, man, he's quick for being 7-2. And I said, well, it's called about anticipation. If you wait and react, you're slow. But if you see the motion, you see the passing lane, I mean, the ball's going from A point A to B. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's a lot of geometry in basketball. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm cheating. And once it gets on his fingertips, I'm gone, because I know he can't bring that ball back.
Do you think that was the best game you ever played? 38 points, 13 rebounds. You were the MVP of the ACC tournament.
I would say it's definitely the best game. I mean, that game meant the most. And really, and David sets that up. I mean, David has 41 in College Park. Or no, 39 in College Park, 41 in Raleigh. So he's only averaging 40 points a game. So Coach Drizel is saying, we can't let David beat us. We can't let David beat us.
It was just putting big guys on him too quick, smaller guys on him, jump too high. And then finally in the ACC tournament, decided, okay, I was going to halfway play. Wherever David was, I would point to him. But, now I allow Tom to be able to get where he wanted to go, and he didn't miss. So everything we tried just didn't seem to work. That's what I mentioned, that, they had too many weapons, too many options.
Well, Lynn Elmore, I love Lenny, and we're good buddies. But he's got this mental psychology that he's the next Lou Alcindor. Well, he's 6'9". Lenny's a great power forward, tremendous player. But 6'9 can't guard 7'2. I mean, I had a drop step. When I learned how to use my drop step, it was a little over 5 feet. I mean, I was like a kid in the candy store. I'd get you going one way, and I just drop my big long leg behind you. I mean, Bo Ellis, I mean, the Marquette game, I score 8 of our first 11 points.
Was that the national championship
national
game?
Championship,
yeah, because you beat Monty. UCLA in the semis, actually,
yeah.
That year.
Yeah, and Monty looks at me and he goes, I look at mine, I said, just keep bringing it in to me, I said, until they make some adjustment. And he said, no. I said, what? He said, Tom, other people have to shoot the ball. He said, you can't be all about you. And I was sort of disappointed at the moment, but Monty always made the right decision.
Keep them all involved and happy.
Keep everybody involved. Don't give it to me. He said, no, Tom. He said, if I need you, I'll come back to you.
Well, the toughest game in that Final Four after you beat Maryland was against UCLA in the semis. Unbelievable game. Another, you played two classics in the matter of weeks. Bill Walton was on the other team. UCLA had won 7 straight NCAA titles. That is hard to believe these days. Anyone could could win three straight. They'd won seven. So talk about your battle with Walton in that game.
Well, that was our primary goal, was to beat UCLA and dethrone that, you know, that wooden dynasty. Every Western sports writer has ever rated the teams. We're like sixth or seventh, and that 72-73 team of Walton, Wilkes, Myers, Washington, Tommy Curtis, Greg Lee, they're number one. That's the stinking team we beat. We beat them. And so, I mean, and Walton said it was, and of course in his documentary, it's like him, this is the most depressing day of my life. As you know, we lost our respect. We lost our dignity and all that kind of good stuff. And I'm going like, yeah, you certainly did. We beat you. But we have David Thompson, you have Monty Tal, you have Tim Starr, you have Phil Spence, you have Mo Rivers. We have Mark Moeller, Craig Kuzmo, Steve News, Greg Hall. We have just a tremendous Smitty, Mike Burma, all the guys, you know, coming off the bench and everything. I mean, we had a top 10 team, you know, was on the bench. I mean, we were just full of talent. But the UCLA game, it took double overtime. But and Walton, and I give him his credit.
And all hell is going to break loose here in about 12 seconds. To hit them both, we're going to have a new national champion.
Now, he was coached by John Wooden. I could jump higher than Walton. Had a better field goal percentage than Walton. I shot free throws better than Walton. And every time we played man or heads up, my team won. I mean, we won the CPAC trophy 6-8, 6-2 in the 8 games we played them in our particular division and all that kind of stuff. And of course, Larry Bird, when Walton starts bragging, Larry goes, Burley ate your lunch every time you played him. Because that was, we were
but
the icons.
Didn't they beat you in the regular season that year?
Well, yeah, they did. That game was getting us ready for the final game. God knew nothing's perfect in God's eyes. So that's the only loss we have in 2 years, 57-51.
That. Yes.
And yeah. If we beat UCLA, and I hate to say this, if we beat UCLA in St. Louis, John Wooden is a great coach, and he's going to come in there with a different game plan against us. And so they come in there overconfident, thinking that they could have beat us like they did in St. Louis. When they were just lucky, well, they were fortunate to win. God was getting us ready for that final game because God knew how that cycle was going to come around. And in order to win the big game, we had to lose that game. You have to learn from your experiences.
We'll be back right after this. Welcome back.
You are writing a book you've mentioned. Have you got a title for it yet?
Play on.
Nice. I like it. That is going to be a wonderful read. I know that you can't encapsulate 40 years in 5 minutes, but give an idea of what you, after basketball was over, what you've done with your life.
So I rededicated my life June 23rd, 1982, to Jesus Christ. And I got married. Danny and I have three sons. Seeing that first boy's face and realizing that he's depending on me for to eat, shelter, and everything. That is a moment that you realize that people are relying on you. So, of course, I went back with my little hardware store. We worked there for a while. I ended up selling out to, you know, the family business to my uncle. And then I was able to get a job as a building inspector. Then went from building inspector to the county planner. I was county planner for 26 years. And
this is back in your hometown?
Hometown of Newland, Avery County, mm-hmm. Grandfather Mountain, Beach Mountain. Of course, Lees McRae's there. We're just south of Boone, Appalachian State.
Gorgeous. I can see why you'd want to return there, you know, even after you've seen a lot of the world.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a, you know, life after basketball. That's part of the big part of the book. I mean, there's so many stories I can tell that where players implode. Once their basketball career is over, they don't know what to do. I mean, it's, you know, you put so much emphasis and so much relying on basketball so much that once you're having to go back to your education and your skills and what you have, you know, how you prepared yourself for life after basketball. And of course, that's why I've chosen the title Play On.
That's wonderful advice and so true. It's just been such a pleasure talking with you today, Tommy. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate you wanting to, you know, relive some of those great moments with us and with me. And like I say, the team, I was on a great team, had great coaches. And, you know, it's all about team sports. And then again, I, you know, in life, there's politics and there's things that goes on that you really don't want to be about the ugly part, but it happens, you know. And then, like I say, I was so involved between the Munich and then, of course, the way my NBA career ended up and stuff and all that. But God had a plan for me and had a job waiting for me, had a life waiting for me. I've had my camp for 40 years now. David Thompson's going to be back. I think Phil Ford's coming this year. And we teach fundamentals. And there's fundamentals in everything you do, everything from education to basketball, to living your life and how you treat people and how you want to be treated. So it's been my privilege, and I thank you very much.
Absolutely. That's Tommy Burleson. I'm Scott Fowler, and this is Sports Legends of the Carolinas.
Thanks so much for listening to Sports Legends of the Carolinas, a production of the Charlotte Observer. This show is produced by Lou May Ali Sally, Jeff Siner, and Cotta Stevens. The sports editor of the Charlotte Observer is Lydia Craver, and the executive editor is Raina Cash. Remember, you'll find much more about this interview and about all of our guests, including Steph Curry, Roy Williams, Dale Earnhardt Jr., and Dawn Staley, in our Sports Legends book. Pre-order your copy now at sportslegendsbook.com. For lots more sports content and to continue supporting this kind of work, please visit charlotteobserver.com and consider a digital subscription. And connect with me on Twitter at Scott_Fowler or email at sfowler@charlotteobserver.com. See you next time.